Hey y'all,
y'all listening to
In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile.
Brendan Sharp is a multifaceted artist having produced work in the abstract, commercial, and pop art worlds. The man took a break from preparing for an upcoming art show to stop by the woodpile and began by explaining his nickname, the Fauve.
Fauvism is the first movement in art of last century and originated by the artist Henri Matisse. And it was called thus because a critic, a French critic, said that it looked like the paintings were tongue lickings on canvas and as if wild beasts had come into the studio and decided to paint. Uh-huh. Matisse and his artistic group, which was a movement that only lasted about 2.5 years, were known as the Fauves. Mm-hmm. But being from the American South, my painting instructor, upon seeing me attempt oil painting for the first time, called me the Fauve. And so the Fauve kind of stuck, and I always try to paint like a wild beast ever since.
Okay. So that answers my next question. Is it an influence on you, or is it something that you got independently and just gravitated towards it because that was your inclination?
Well, it was sort of an affectionate, I don't want to say insult, but it was, the instructor at the time was trying to, he had learned directly from Cézanne, and Cézanne is akin to Matisse in that they're both considered masters, but Cézanne had a lot more principle behind his use of color, and Matisse was more emotionally driven, and his biggest tenet was to paint as a child would see the world. Mm-hmm. That's what he and Picasso agreed upon most, even though they were sort of opposed to one another until the very end. Mm-hmm. Cézanne, on the other hand, wanted to paint nature as it was seen, not how it was perceived, much like the Impressionists that followed, but he also want to convey time of day, and the way that you do that is by, you know, sort of, I guess, guesstimating what time of day you started the painting and how much sunlight had absorbed into your subject, and then you would begin to paint color that way. And I was kind of skipping ahead and pulling these really hot colors. Mm-hmm. And so the instructor, Sammy Britt, who taught at Delta State University, was like, okay, Fauve, we're going to tone those colors down, you know, and try to focus on what I'm telling you. And, uh-huh. But I took to it. I thought it was hilarious, so I stuck with Fauve, and then I used it throughout high school and governor school and mm-hmm. and college, you know, just finding colors that brought out emotions in people, you know, the viewer. That perhaps weren't necessarily found in nature, but were right at home in the painting. A lot of the things with the pop art, the challenges that I create for myself are simply just to get as close to a likeness or you know, a message that I can. And then once I've developed those skills, then I can reappropriate them with a, you know, more painterly style. But I like the commercialization of it. Mm-hmm. We're so accustomed to seeing that mm-hmm. in the world that I like emulating it to convey a message that's more honest.
For example?
Well, I've got a show coming up, and it's called Game of Drones. And there's a very popular TV show on HBO called Game of Thrones. And then we're in perhaps the longest war in recent memory, but a lot of us are detached from it because we've been at this war for so long, and fewer soldiers are being utilized to fight this war because we've started using drones, which mm-hmm. kind of furthers our detachment. Uh-huh. I just find both the show and this aspect of our lives very fascinating, and I thought the two were very timely to combine together. But if I did it in a super painterly, choppy way, I don't think it would necessarily come across. I think it would take a lot longer for people to sort of get an instant reaction. Mm-hmm. And so it actually takes longer for me to have that more refined brush stroke. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a commitment to create a painting that way. Yeah. So you know, when I'm trying to get something across, I paint more deliberately that way. So that's a lot of intent behind each stroke.
As far as I know, this is like the first show that you've done that I'm aware of that was a little political, slightly. I mean, I know you're not really trying to take a side, but is this the first time?
No, I'm glad you asked that. What I had done before, because, you know, I realized that, you know, sort of like a mad rant visually on canvas is not necessarily what you want over your fireplace or your couch.
Yeah.
And so what I had done the
Maybe
past...
in your compound.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I had done in the past decade when I was painting in Nashville was I kind of made the show itself sort of political, but then each individual piece would be something you might want to take home. Uh-huh. And I was honored one time when I had an art show at Jackson's, which I've now become very familiar with showing there, but it's not the only place I've ever shown. And the staff there had gotten off shift, took a smoke break of sorts, and then came back. And for the first time, someone actually understood the entire purpose of my show. They looked at one painting and then another and realized that they were in relation. And I was basically, it was called Aloha Nashville. And the reason why I chose to paint it was because everything that's so likable about Hawaii, aside of the climate, is not indigenous to the state or the islands. They're from all over. It's like wherever certain plants thrive to make it appear more like paradise. And I'm like, wow, well, you know, if the climate were more suitable, we'd have palm trees in Nashville, or we'd have, you know, sandbars along all our lakes. And so then what would be the allure? You know, so that was why I chose to paint it. But then as I began painting it, I sort of began to paint the history of it. Now, if you were to walk into that show, you would have said, oh, there's a pirate ship and there's a surfer and here's some patterns from a Hawaiian shirt. You know, he's really covered it. He's run the gamut. But what they figured out was is like that pirate ship was actually the first white settlers that came. You know, and then I had a portrait of Don Ho, who unfortunately had passed not long after that show. And I admire his talent at work, but it was, you know, kind of the first sort of export of Hawaii as a state. And it sort of created this culture that was bankable for Hawaii as a state. And so he was kind of the first to sort of trade in his cultural heritage for fame, you know, and they picked up on that, and then, like, you know, the patterns of the Hawaiian shirt, which sold right away, they were like, you know, and these are the wares, they're cultural wares that they suddenly, you know, that were sacred at one point, and now we all wear when we are on vacation. And I'm like, yeah, you got it. I was like, thank you for understanding. You know, so that was how I did it before. This time, yes, I'm taking more of a direct stance in incorporating something that is political within my art. And, you know, it's a little bit daring, but I'm kind of proud of that. And I think you'll find that there's humor in it too, so it's not something that's difficult to digest while you're eating at Jackson's.
Okay. I remember one of your shows was the Atari Party.
That's right, yeah.
That was one of my favorites. Did you have a point in that? Or was it just fun?
Yeah, I had a point in it, and part of that point was fun, but I think what was interesting about that is that technology was so pervasive and so important, and it was already antiquated to the point that people found it charming. But there was an innocence associated with it that's gone now in video gaming, and so I wanted to kind of harken back to that.
Well, explain what you painted for the Atari Party.
Well, Atari 2600 basically utilized pre-8-bit graphics, so they were very primitive. Much like music or anything else, commercials, the album art was always so spectacular, and then the actual graphics were so pitiful. Yeah. And, you know, when you're a kid, you're just so excited to have something that's uniquely yours that you can play for hours on end and have friends over. So you didn't question it all that much. Mm-hmm. But I remember being baffled by it. It's like you really had to use your imagination, even though you were kind of being guided to do so.
Well, it was the E.T. game, right?
Yeah, the E.T. game was probably one of my first sort of politically charged paintings that was well received and sold. And in that regard, that painting talked about the game itself, which was an absolute dud, but it was a real testament to a couple of things. Like, corporate America had just realized that you could make money at video games that were associated directly with cinema. And so they made a huge push to get the game out the door just in time for Christmas. And unfortunately, by doing that, the game was ineffective. It really didn't work. Fans became frustrated.
Did it even look like E.T.?
It barely did, but more so than, say, Pitfall looked like an explorer with a pith helmet, you know, so. But what happened was, is they didn't sell enough. It was a hot ticket, and then word got out that the game was, you know, pitiful. And so they buried 18 tractor trailers full of the E.T. game in New Mexico. And I think only recently did they dig some of them up.
Yeah, I heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, but I painted that in like 2007. Uh-huh. So I had the album art. I'm saying album art, but packaging art, and then had the actual game, and then I had like kind of a vista that would be New Mexico, and you know, sort of the disappointment, and then I had a kind of a written statement that sort of associated with it. And what was neat was there was a guy that owns a computer store, like secondhand computers, and he does really well for himself. And he bought the piece because he kind of understood every aspect about it. Mm-hmm. And so he appreciated that it was done. So I felt really validated for having taken that chance. So that was my pièce de résistance at the Atari party. But the rest of them were, you know, just sort of humorous. And and it was also an interactive show in that you could play Atari at all the bars at Jackson's, which was kind of fun. So it was ambitious and yet lighthearted take on old video gaming.
I know as a creative person that when you make something, it's almost like it's your child, and you get a little sensitive sometimes if someone, you know, doesn't quite understand it, or they may make an offhand comment and maybe critical or something. First of all, do you experience that? And second of all, are your nerves racked before you have a show? Because it's like your soul is up on the wall, and especially some of the places you've shown where, you know, people have alcohol in them and they may tend to be a little bit more you know, like rude and that thing. Is that something that you have to deal with a lot, or?
When I showed in clubs, that happened more. You know, I had people take lipstick and put mustaches on my portraits. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's terrible.
Back in the Jody Faison days, I showed in just about every one of his establishments, and a couple of them, you know.
Did that just make you livid?
I was pretty upset, and you know, the staff and, you know, even Jody himself, to some degree, was not very reverent of that or concerned.
Yeah.
You know, and just sort of said it was more me taking a risk by showing art there in the first place. So, so in that regard, yeah. I mean, when I started out, I showed anywhere I could, and I'd get calls at 3 a.m. and I'd meet, you know, these coked out dudes that just wanted to impress somebody at the bar and wanted to be able to say they bought that painting, you know, and I was willing to sort of facilitate that for a time, and then that, after a while, I was like, you know, I don't know if I like this lifestyle. It's kind of fun and adventuresome, but at the same time, like, I don't know what I'm getting into with these people, because sometimes they would call and I would, you know, it's 3 a.m. and I'd get up and I'd drive out there and they'd be gone, you know. Like Kings of Leon did that to me.
Oh, no. Really?
Yeah.
So they saw one of your paintings, loved
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Wanted to buy it and then disappeared.
Had Jackson's call me. And I was working for Maxim at the time, and I was working like 12-hour days, and they were like, yeah, come up and we'll you know, purchase it now. It was a painting of Chuck Norris with an American flag and two Uzis.
Yeah.
And you know, I was like, oh, this is great. I like their music, and yeah. I'll get a chance to meet them. And so I drove 30 miles north, and they weren't there, and I was like, did this even just happen? I mean, was I dreaming?
Did the staff, like, notice they had left, or?
Yeah, and they, you know, so they said that no one was recognizing them, so they decided they'd buy a painting to kind of assert that they were who they thought. That's what was told to me. That might have been just to make me feel better, but I found it interesting. I had to find it something. So I put my soul out there, and I get really nervous, and I'm worried, the way I paint, people comment, you know, that I'm prolific in the way that I've been able to accomplish that is I have a deadline and I have to make it, and so sometimes I put work up that isn't the way I envisioned it, but it's close enough that it fills the space in the venue, and then later I'll go back and see a video or something, and I'll be like, oh, if I had just spent a little more time on that, you know. So and in a lot of ways I'm my own worst critics, so what could be my worst nightmare is some sort of affirmation about that from someone. So I haven't had too much of that, but I've had some. So, it's a lesson in humility each time.
I was talking to a minister, and he was talking about how he had collected a lifetime of sweet moments in his line of work with your paintings, and obviously you affect people, hopefully for the good. What are some sweet moments you've collected?
Well, that's a really good question. I probably need a little more preparation, but off the top of my head, I've had people that, you know, have said that, you know, I bought this painting for my wife for our 20th anniversary, wedding anniversary, and, you know,
she left me.
And she left me.
No, I'm just kidding.
No, that'd be great. And then they would come back and tell me that, you know, she loved it, and they look at that every day and think of their life together. And I've had some real moments where people have just been completely touched by something I've tried to accomplish, and then consequently, I have a moment too where I'm just like, you know, I got through to someone. Mm-hmm. You know, with art, I get literal in some of my interpretations through that pop culture kind of reference that we discussed earlier. But even so, I mean, it's almost like you're speaking your own language and you're waiting for someone to understand. Uh-huh. And when that finally does happen and there's this click, then, you know, it's difficult to know what to do beyond that because you've done it, you've accomplished it. Mm-hmm. And I've had several of those. I've been really fortunate in that regard.
If you want to direct people to your artwork, where should they go on the internet?
Ah, well, they can see my artwork at artbybrennan.com. And I have an art show in Nashville.
And Brennan is spelled what?
B-R-E-N-A-N.
Okay.
But in case you add a third N, you can still get there.
Okay.
And I have an upcoming art show at Jackson's Bar and Bistro in Hillsborough Village in Nashville, Tennessee, June 11th, 6 to 10 p.m. And I believe you'll be there, is that correct?
Yes, that's true. I will be rocking people's buttocks.
That's awesome.
With music. And you do commissions, right?
I do, yes.
Okay. In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile podcast is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. And a special thanks to thebrofisticate.com.